Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And I have such a cool show today because I have some real pros with me today. And we're celebrating a new play. Actually, it's not a new play. It's a revision of a play. And it is called 154 in Paradise. And Richard should be like all over this one because he lives right in that area. It's 154 in Paradise because it's involving the story of an accident that takes place in our backyard here in Santa Barbara. The play is written by Gerald DiPeggio. And I want to introduce everybody that's here. This is a play that's produced by the producing unit. And Bill Egan, who's been on our show before, is one of the founders. He's an actor, director, producer. He's been working in this genre for 20, 30 years. Past venues include the Rubicon, the Garvin, Circle Bar B, the Libero, and then the producing unit, obviously. He is, like I said, an actor who originated the role of James in the world premiere 7 years ago. Michael in God of Carnage, James in Time Stand Still, Hank in What Rhymes with America, and Michael in How to Translate a Happy Marriage. Directorial credits, Private Wars, It Had to Be You, Steel Magnolias. The list goes on. And he is partnering with Peter Frisch. Now, Peter, it's funny. I was in high school, believe it or not, in Chicago, and there was two high schools that were kind of like famous for their drama departments. Mine was one of them, and Steppenwolf Theater was just getting started at the time. And I remember our director, Eileen Kransky, was our drama teacher. She said, "Who wants to go paint sets for this new company called Steppenwolf Downtown?" And I volunteered. That was the first time I heard Peter's name. Believe it or not, I've known Peter that long, or of him. And just a little bit about Peter. I actually called Richard yesterday, Peter, about you, because I said, this is one of the great pros of our nation. He's directed 160 productions in New York and regional theaters, et cetera. Classical, contemporary, plays, musical, cabaret, operas, network television in Los Angeles, producing director of Hyde Park Festival in New York, resident director with Berkshire Theater Festival, artistic director of American Playwrights Theater in Washington, D.C., Joseph Jefferson Award for Chicago premiere of American Dreams, co-authored with Studs Terkel, famous Chicago personality. And the list goes on regards, you know, the Chicago credits. But he was creative producer on Fox Network's Tribes, producer on CBS The Young and the Restless, and directed several films. And this is, you know, this is internationally recognized teacher, coach. He's taught at Juilliard, Harvard, Boston University, Carnegie Mellon. He chaired their famous School of Drama. And Peter actually received his MFA at CMU, panelist for National Endowment for the Arts, for the Fulbright Committee, the Board of Society of Stage Directors and Choreographers. And I mean, just, this is a pro. I said to Richard, I often dream of hiring Peter to teach me how to be really confident when I walk in a room. And that's all I want to, you know, I don't want to act. I just want to know how to burst into a room full of confidence. And Peter would be the guy I would go to first for that. And so Peter is here today. And then our playwright, I mean, like I said, this is a golden, golden group of people. Gerald DiPeggio was raised in Northeastern Illinois. He was raised in a family grocery store, but his food was movies and books. Came to California at age 30 as a novelist and screenwriter. He's written 5 books. And, you know, let me just brag a little bit on Jerry. He is a famous and highly successful screenwriter. I interviewed him once before on this show in regards to a book about how to write that he wrote. He's sole credit for writing Phenomenon with John Travolta. He wrote The Forgotten with, can you believe this, Richard, with Peter Frisch's student, Julianne Moore. So their relationship goes back. He wrote Message in a Bottle with Kevin Costner, Instinct with Anthony Hopkins, Angel Eyes with Jennifer Lopez, and Sharky's Machine with Burt Reynolds, and many, many other. And here's how Peter and Jerry met. So Peter obviously was teaching, and he was teaching in San Ynez Valley. And Jerry appeared in Peter's class saying he spent his life with the finest of the finest actors, but he never acted himself. And he wanted to take an acting class with me, with Peter, to see what acting was like. And Peter and Jerry became instant friends. And Peter's class inspired Jerry to write a play. He wasn't a playwright before this. And this is the play that came of it. Now, it's been done before, but in researching the notes for today, I learned that because the cast is so interesting and so cerebral, that the cast decided to go a kind of a different way with Jerry's play. And we're going to hear about that because I want Bill to talk about that as well. I have one other great person to introduce, Lisa Beck. She is doing her first show with Producing Unit. She's a star in Santa Barbara, including Countess Adrenia Murda on the Orient Express, Elvira in Blythe Spirit, Stephanie in Time of My Life, Mrs. Rowland in Before Breakfast, Maggie in Red Herring, L.A. credits, Portia in The Merchant of Venice at the MET Theater, and then A Midsummer's Night's Dream at Raven Playhouse, Natasha and Three Sisters at Vanguard. She's appeared in independent films, TVs, commercials, and performs as a jazz vocalist and is a graduate of Cornell. Very cool cast and very cool. Everybody here is just an excellent, excellent pro. And Bill, I wonder if you can introduce the show a little bit and tell folks where to get tickets and tell me a little bit about how this happened.
Well, sure. Well, 7 years ago, we were fortunate enough to be able to do this show, and it was our bestseller of to date of what we have produced. And many folks missed it, and they said, "Boy, we'd love to have the chance to see it again." So when the opportunity arose, and Peter, you can jump here as well at any time because you were part of obviously the decision in which to remount that. But it's got a local hook with the 154 in Paradise, of course. You know, Jerry, and we're going to hear from Jerry as well, where he will talk about the show. But we just wanted to remount it, and because the ultimate goal here is to, this piece needs a broader audience. We would like to take this to other places if we can, just because it's such a well-written piece and super intriguing, unique. And, you know, this revision hopefully will start the word on the journey in which to do that some more. Peter, I don't know if you have some thoughts on that.
Well, I would say that you mean on the revival?
Yes.
That we did. Yeah. I think it has to do with what you said, Bill, which is we definitely felt that this was the one of the, if not the strongest show that we've done. And yet it is not a published show yet. It has not been done in New York. You know, at the time when we first looked at scripts, this is about 2015 when we did it first. We looked at a number of scripts that had gotten New York Times reviews with great, you know, accolades and other things that had been done around the country, you know, the top produced productions around the country. And then Jerry wrote this script and we looked at it and we thought, this is as good or better than anything that we've seen nationally. It's a remarkable piece. It's a piece of magic realism that slowly unfolds and develops and surprises us at every turn. And it, even the last second is a surprise. And Jerry has that incredible ability to surprise us. And yet it seems also natural and organic to the plot development as it happens. And, you know, those two things are pretty rare.
Can I ask Peter, what is magical realism?
A magical realism is a literary style which has to do with not being overtly realistically where you are. You think you're in one place, you think you're in a particular universe, suddenly things shift and we realize that we're in a different universe. And these kinds of things happen during the play where we accept certain pieces of knowledge and what seems to be real and what seems to move on. And then suddenly we realize, wait a second, we're actually in this new place and we have been all along. And Jerry does this a number of times during the play so that a kind of suspense is revealed to be this wonderful new arena that we had not expected before.
Jerry, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, Jerry. Hey, hi. I want you to just there's two things that sprung out as I was looking at the show and doing the research. And I think they're very prescient. These are two like streams that just came up for me. One is the plays dealing with the nature of truth. And in this universe we have now of alternate facts and everybody being woke and truth being everybody's, you know, own interpretation. I thought, how prescient, how, you know, how front and center is that? The second thing I want you to tell us about is something that came up, which is what responsibility do we owe each other in the face of this truth? Can you talk about that for me?
I think that's the when you talk about the final nugget of the play, I think that's what it is, what we owe each other, what we, you know, why we're here and what we can do in just a few minutes, in just some sort of encounter with someone. It matters. That moment matters. And that's the very bottom of a play, I think. And hopefully that's what people can carry out of the theater. And it's not a play where the messages are hidden. I mean, they're spoken. They're actually spoken within the play. So it's not something you have to figure out, but it takes a really good cast to do it that way. But the message is spoken about how the briefest little encounter with someone else in the world is an important thing for both of us. And we should be prepared for that. We should be ready. We should have some sort of giving within us, you know, that can open up.
It's interesting, Jerry. I remember this is years and years and years ago. It must have been 35 years ago. And I remember getting on a plane and noticing someone and looking down at this person to see if he had a wedding ring on. And I never forgot that. And we had like five words, but I can see him today, 35 years later. And it was just a short little, you know, getting on a plane together. And I know what you're talking about. You know, Richard's giving us that sign that we have to go to quick break. I just want to, Bill, would you just do a shout out where folks can buy tickets, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. The producing unit is performing at Center Stage Theater, which is the theater on top of the Paseo Nuevo Mall. We open tonight and we run through September 30th. Tickets can be found at www.ticketour.com/CS Theater/tickets.
Can you say that one more time? Ticket tour?
www.ticketour.com/CS Theater/tickets, or they can also just go to the Center Stage Theater website and get the tickets there.
Okay, that's fantastic. That's probably easier. Go to Center Stage tickets and get your tickets there. And it runs tonight, and then give us the timing.
8 o'clock tonight, 8 o'clock tomorrow night. 8 o'clock p.m. is the 22nd and 23rd, the 29th and 30th. We have a 7:30 p.m. show on September 28th. And then September 23rd and 30th, we also have two matinees at 2:30.
Those particular dates are on the site. If you go to centerstagetheater.org, you'll also find those dates once you hit tickets. So that'll be obvious.
Excellent. Okay, let's go to quick break. When we get back, I really would like to ask, of course, I'd like to ask Peter his impressions and how he worked. I mean, how does Peter, who's this seasoned, wonderful teacher, wonderful, wonderful associate with many, many stars over the years. I mean, Lisa, what is it like working with somebody like that? I mean, you know, as an actor, how? I want to talk about that when we get back from the break. All right, everybody, we're going to go to quick break. We're celebrating Gerald DiPeggio's play that is a reprise and a very important play right now, talking about the nature of truth and our responsibility to each other, 154 in Paradise. And believe it or not, it's a murder. And we'll talk a little bit about how that works into the whole picture, too. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Okay, Elizabeth Stewart here, and I am with Lisa Beck, Gerald DiPeggio, Peter Frisch, and Bill Egan of the producing unit. We are talking about Gerald DiPeggio's play 154 in Paradise, and yes, it is exactly those roads we're talking about. And before the break, I asked Lisa what it's like to be performing with a teacher, a coach, a mind, an intellect, as we have Peter Frisch here. Lisa, what is that like? Are you ever intimidated?
You know, this is my first show with the producing unit, and I will admit that one of the reasons I hadn't auditioned for shows previously, I was a little bit intimidated. I had, because I knew that Peter had been at Juilliard and had, you know, been at all these amazing places. And I was kind of picturing working with him being like working with like James Lipton or so. Like I was picturing him being very pompous and actually it's been completely the opposite. He's just fantastic. He's so warm. He's so generous to the actors. He creates a fun environment. It's been one of the more fun plays that I have, in addition to being just a fantastic script and a fantastic cast and, you know, just a wonderful experience artistically. It's actually been a really fun experience to work on the show too, because Peter does create a really wonderful, warm environment for the actors. So yes, it seems like he would be intimidating, but he's actually fantastic to work with.
So Peter, I have a question. So my sister is a SAG actress, and she works with a number of different directors, et cetera. And she's and then in my life, you know, I'm a theater nerd because I didn't do any performing, but I went into set design, and I did set design for ACT, Dallas Theater Center, Pittsburgh Ballet. I did in Russia. I was all over the place doing set design, which is how I got into appraising art. But I did a lot of set design over the years. And there are certain directors that do not let an actor have an opinion at all. And there's certain directors that do. What's your school on that?
Well, first of all, let me return the compliment to Lisa, who's been delightful to work with. Tremendous fun. And you know, she's a good part of making that atmosphere fun and adventurous and pleasant. So I will need to say that as well. What was it in terms of getting the actor to, what were you saying, to give them the question, give them how much leeway or how?
Right. So do you like, oh, my sister has this joke that she tells about a certain director. And she says, well, you know, she's in her house. This is her joke. She's in her house. She's nearly murdered. And her husband comes home and says, my God, you know, we've got to call your friends to rally around you and this sort of thing. And so the husband calls the director of the play she's in, and she's in a kind of a semi-coma. And when the director comes in, she wakes up and she says, oh, the director, he came to the house. Like the director would have anything to do with the performer. And so that the performer, in your mind, does the performer have an opinion? Do you listen to the actor when they're saying, well, I think I should do this?
A play is a complete collaboration.
Yep.
We are together as a group of people to explore the material. I do not play their role when it comes to being on stage. They play their role. If they are not, and I don't like to use the word comfortable when it comes to acting, but if they are not satisfied with their exploration, it's going to show on stage. So my job, and I believe the job of a director, at least for the first half of the rehearsal period, is to create frameworks for exploration. Mm-hmm. That's the initial job of the director.
Bill, did I hear you start to talk?
I was clearing my throat. Was also a nod. I've worked with Peter, I think, I don't know, Peter, 7-10 times. And the atmosphere that he creates in the very beginning is, he does provide the framework, but it's a complete dialogue. If something isn't working for me, I will ask him about it. And sometimes I'm right, I feel. And sometimes the thing that's great about working with Peter is that he gives a reason for if it's not working. You don't get that with some directors. Some directors are very dictatorial, says, no, just do it this way. But the wonderful thing about the atmosphere that's created here is it does become a dialogue. And sometimes, and I think Peter will freely admit this, is that some of the actors sometimes in that dialogue will bring up something that he hasn't thought about before. And he says, oh, I haven't seen it that way. And then it changes. I will say this time around, this is my second time playing James. There are things that have been discovered about this time around that did not even come into the picture the first time that it was played. So that's really been a blessing to be able to explore that in a different way. But it comes with the collaboration of the atmosphere that Peter does create, and it is a true dialogue.
I'll say related to that, because I didn't do the show the previous time. It was a different actress playing the role that I'm playing. And I didn't see it that time. And I've been told that I play it pretty differently than the person who played it previously. And I think that's one of the wonderful things. It, you know, if Peter had come in with a really specific idea that he wanted to recreate what had happened before, well, he's got different actors and they bring different things to roles. And that would have been very, very difficult to do. So I think that leeway that he provides for people to explore and find the characters themselves is what makes it work. And it makes it a really rich performance, and it makes it really different than the previous time. So we have found really different things, I think, than and the show will look different. So people who saw it before, you should come back, because it's going to be a different show this time.
Can I ask Jerry, I hate to do this, Jerry, but can I ask you just to summarize the arc of the play for us?
The play actually begins a week and a half after there has been a fatal accident on 154 in Paradise Road. And an examiner gathers all the people who had any contact with the deceased man on the last day of his life. So you have this room full of people. All of them have, you know, strong emotions, because they've known this man. And one by one, he talks to them, and they talk to each other. And they're looking for, the examiner is looking for the truth. And each person believes they're bringing in their own truth, or maybe they're hiding a little bit of their own truth. And it's that examination that gets down finally at the end of the play to the very truth of the 154 and Paradise Calamity.
Why is the examiner not named?
Because he's not, I mean, he does give his name. They ask him, what is your name? And he tells them, but that's all he tells them. Because he's not, you know, this is where magical realism comes into it. He's not somebody you can place. You know, he doesn't finish his examination and then go home to dinner with his family. He's operating in a world that is partially magical.
May I ask why is he so involved with finding the truth? The notes are telling me that the examiner shows up to find the truth about James Henney out of a pool of like 7,000 different deaths that he could have examined. Why does he pick this one?
That's actually asked in the play. Why? And he says, well, that's my job. I showed up because that's my job. So it's not like he's got this burning personal notion about finding out. He is the examiner, and that's his job. And this is what he was given, and he does it well.
Were you thinking of anything recent in our own living history when you were thinking of the role of an examiner?
Not necessarily. No, it's just an invention.
And then finally, the idea of choosing the investigation of the last day of this man's life. Why did you select that particular time frame, the last day?
Well, because it's so much more powerful than, you know, the last year of his life, the last this of his life. We're going to one particular day, and the play just coalesces that way. You know, that's what we're looking at, this one day from the time he woke up to the time he died. And so it makes it very compact, and I think more powerful that way.
I have to say it's been interesting because my partner, John, has been on the road for almost 2 months. He's on a walkabout. He took a car and he just traveled across the country. He's stopping where he wants. He's doing what he wants. He's got a bike on the back of the car. You know, he finds himself in a town. He starts to talk with the hotel staff. And when I was reading about this in the play notes, involving the powerful ways in which we are interconnected and the responsibility we have to each other. As the examiner states, I love this, every encounter is a chance to affect someone's life. Even if they go on and live 100 years or they die in the next hour, we had a chance. What did we say? How did we look at them? What about tomorrow on the street, in the store, in our home, in our bed? What do we say? How will we look at them? Will we take the chance or let it go? And it's so interesting because my partner's telling me about these chance encounters with people and how it can change his mood, his day, his driving style, the place he goes next.
Powerful, yeah.
Peter, one more time, tell folks how to get the tickets, when the performances are, do a shout out. So in case they got a pen and paper, let's let them know.
We open tonight, which is the 22nd, and we close on the Saturday night the following week, which is the 30th. And all those times in between, evenings and matinees, excuse me, sorry, getting over a cold. All those times can be found on www. centerstagetheater.org. Theater is T-E-R, not T-R-E. centerstagetheater.org. And when you get onto that, you'll see our little, promotional sign. And it says, one of the tabs says tickets. Press tickets and you'll see all those dates in between. But basically, we're talking Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, Saturday matinee, and Sunday matinee this particular week.
When we get back from the break, I want everybody here, Bill and Peter and Lisa and Jerry, I want to have an example from each of you, maybe from the play, maybe from your life, of this particular theme that I'm seeing here, that truth is an act, an action. Truth is an act. So I love an example, maybe drawn from the play, maybe drawn from your own life, of truth as an act. And not an interpretation, not an opinion, not a conjecture, but an act, an action. Love to have an example when we get back from the break. Hey, Richard. Let's go to quick break. When we get back, I want to hear the reaction to the statement, truth is an act. We are celebrating a play by Gerald DePego, who is a fantastic writer. This is a play that is going to be performed at Center Stage by the producing unit. My friend Bill Egan has actually emailed Richard and myself and said, this is an important piece of theater that you ought to cover, and I agree. Don't turn that dial back in a minute. It's Elizabeth Stewart. We're talking about a play that is super interesting to me. It's 154 in Paradise. And yes, it is our own 154 in Paradise. And it's that really dangerous, you know, Richard, you know what I'm talking about, that really dangerous, you know, slip onto the road there. And there's what I was reading is that even this is going to kind of blow your mind, Richard. So to do the play, they went and studied the visual obstruction and noticed everybody speeding on the pass. And the site of the fictional crash was photographed and measured by Bill and the rest of a number of the cast. When the examiner in the play is showing the photos, Richard, of the crash site, they're actual photos of the site. Isn't that cool? You know what I'm talking about, right? Right there, it's where you are up at your ranch.
Yes, yes, I know what you're referring to. Yeah. And it definitely is dangerous.
Yeah. So just a quick segue back to my question. I asked before the break if all of my guests could give me an example of truth as an act. I never thought about an act, a truth as an act. I'm acting a truth. And Lisa, can I start with you? So give me an example of what that means. What truth as an act?
Well, I'll talk about an example from the play. This comes up a lot over the course of the play because they're looking back on an accident. And we've all heard the things about if you talk to people who witnessed an accident, you know, all the witnesses will have a different story. It'll sound, you know, they'll all have seen something different because our memories are fallible and we remember things the way we want to remember them, or we remember things because we focused on this particular thing and it became bigger in our minds than it was in reality. And so that's one of the challenges that they're dealing with in the play, is they're trying to reconstruct what happened on this person's last day, but people's memories are so different from the reality of what happened. And so that's really what the play is trying to get at, is that the reality of what happened in that instant is the truth. That's the truth. And what we carry within us, what we remember, the way we saw things is not necessarily the truth. It's sort of a lie that we tell ourselves. It's a really interesting piece to explore that. And we all see that in our everyday lives. I argue with my teenagers about, you know, our different opinions about the way that things all the time, every single day. So I just love that exploration. I'll pass it over to somebody else.
Yes, especially as you're saying, you know, this is so interesting to me. I was actually involved. I witnessed an accident in Goleta on Hollister, and cops came, pulled over a bunch of us that had witnessed this accident, and we all spoke what we thought we saw, and that it was all different, even down to the, you know, the height of the person. I think one was the sex was different. I mean, how different? It was just amazingly different. And we were all standing together waiting to cross the street. You know, how can that be so different? Anyway, Peter, give me an example. Truth is an act.
Well, I'm going to give you an example of both themes that immediately came to me when you asked that question. And the themes, again, are, yes, truth is an act. But the other theme, of course, is the request for kind acts and the way that sort of like the butterfly effect, we affect each other no matter what we do. The slightest thing, we affect each other. And I thought of this funny incident where I was recovering from surgery decades ago, and a very close friend of mine came in right as I was waking up from surgery and came in with a little miniature toy monkey that when you press the bottom of the monkey, it just collapsed. And then you let go of the bottom button and it, you know, became the monkey again. And for some reason, this affected me in a very deep way. It was a warming, extraordinary presence. The monkey itself was true. It was, you know, no question, she delivered it. It was an object. There was not interpretation, but it also was a kind act that meant a great deal to me, to the fact that maybe 40 years later now, I'm remembering that with fondness. And I kept that monkey for decades, you know, just because it affected me so deeply. And yet it was, she, you know, she just went and she knew exactly what to get. And it was a powerful, kind act, as small as it was.
Do you think that that monkey was you?
Well, that's an interesting potential interpretation. No, I don't. I think it was just very funny and very sweet. And what I do think was, it was symbolic of that relationship.
It's why I think about, you know, that collapsing and rebuilding is that, well, Richard knows I was in ballet for many, many, many years, and therefore I have hips to prove it and knees to prove it and the joints in my you know, the ball of my foot to prove it. And I had three surgeries this past couple of years on one hip to try to rebuild it, and it hasn't been all that successful. And when, you know, you're recovering from that kind of surgery, to think of yourself as collapsed and then, you know, being whole again, that's what I was kind of thinking. Oh, I felt like that monkey myself.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So let's see, Bill, truth is an act. Can you reflect on that for us?
You know, I was thinking about that on the break, and really, I'd actually like to use a quote from the show to kind of answer that and do that. And it's actually a quote from The Examiner. Just the importance of truth, whether it's actually bad or good. And, you know, he says, you know, the truth isn't bad or good. It's just there to be discovered, seen clearly, and studied to do that. So I think it's super important to look at that.
Yeah,
it's not, the truth is not bad or good, but
the truth isn't bad or good. It's just there to be discovered, seen clearly, and studied, and that's part of what he does. But truth, and I think it speaks to what people have said here, that someone's truth may not be what other truth. You use the example of the accident. Everyone had a different version of what was going on. Might be good, might be bad to that particular person, but it doesn't matter if it's bad or good, it's to that person, but it needs to be studied and examined clearly. And that's part of what we do in this show.
So Jerry, so the final question would be to you in regards to this truth as an act and your opinion of it, because what Bill is saying is it's not bad or good. It's there to be discovered. But I want to ask, as all actions have an end point, to what end is truth being discovered? What are you going to do with the truth? What action comes of discovering the truth, Jerry?
Well, it's interesting that the examiner talks about the full and final truth, because the whole play, people are saying what they believe is true, or sometimes they're hedging a little bit, but comes down to the full and final truth. And the truth being an act can be as simple as, okay, you're walking down the street and there's somebody walking toward you and they're having a little trouble with their cane, an older person, and you're about to pass each other. Hello, how you doing? I'm doing okay. And you can very easily just pass by. Or you could say, are you having a little trouble there? Can I help you? And maybe you help them across the street or something like that. You know, so I mean, that's the kind of decisions that the play in various ways brings up, that kind of thing, where in that sense, there is an act. It's not just two people in passage, but you can make it an act.
So Jerry, Richard's giving us a sign we got to go to quick break, but I'm interested to know, if truth is an act, is it an act of character? Is that what we're looking for there? Is it an act of character? And like what you're saying, the example of the old person with the cane and drops the cane and you go to pick it up, is your truth your character? I want to hear about that when we get back from the break. Hey, Richard. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm celebrating a play, 154th and Paradise, written by Gerald DiPeggio. And Gerald is here talking about the play, along with Peter Frisch, the director, and Bill Egan, one of the founders of the producing unit, who's doing the play, and Lisa Beck, one of the beautiful actors in the play. And I want to do just a few minutes asking Jerry. He's quoted as saying one of the main themes of this play is the nature of truth. And then a couple of times during our discussion of the play, he said the full and final truth. And I want to ask Jerry two questions. And I know we only have like 3 minutes, Jerry, but maybe very quickly. Can a truth be made? Number one, so you make a truth. And number two, why is truth final?
Well, you really have to get down to the simple idea that the truth is exactly what happened in this case. They're trying to find out exactly what happened at that intersection. And you can't get around the exact and final truth. It's just one thing, and it's not necessarily good or bad or somebody's opinion. There's no opinion. You finally get down to the very nub of, in this case, exactly what happened in that second, in that intersection. And that's the truth, the full and final truth. I don't want to give it away, but that's what the play comes down to, finding that truth.
Is it such that you can say that when I was saying, why is the truth final? Is the truth being final the fact that the gentleman involved in the accident is dead?
Well, in this case, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And actually, if I can just interject here, earlier on, you had mentioned the word murder. And that's not something that we'd like to say about what happened, because there needs to be some intrigue there on there. So in your editing, Richard, if you could take that out, of what Elizabeth had said.
Okay. Yes, very good. Very good. Very good. So just a really quick shout out. The play is opening tonight, and if you're listening, and it's September 22nd, the play is opening at 8 o'clock at Center Stage Theater. You can get your tickets, Center Stage Theater website, and it's going to be running to the 30th at various times. So take a look at the website, Center Stage Theater, for 154th and Paradise. Thank you, guys.